Recording in progress.
And click on the meetings button or go to /CTHC/meetings. The agenda and some of the materials that we'll be reviewing are at that location. The recordings from the first meeting are at that location too, as well as some of the materials from the first meeting. And that's where everything will be as we move forward. As minutes are produced and made public, they will be available there as well. If you look at the agenda and you'd like to make public comment, you can email that email info.tribalaffairs@gov.ca.gov, and you can submit public comment throughout this meeting and outside of this meeting as well, and we will take it under submission. You can also submit, you can also raise your hand to give public comment in this meeting, and there will be a time at each agenda item to give public comment. You will be limited to 3 minutes, and then there will be general public comment at the end of the meeting for anything that was not on the agenda. Let's see, you can watch this via CalSpan, which I'm sure many of you are, or you can use the Zoom link to join the webinar. If you are watching via CalSpan, there is not the chat option, so we encourage you to either join via Zoom to raise your hand and join, or to join via telephone where you can interact as well. And that information is on the first page of the agenda as well. So with that, I very quickly would like to introduce to the group Loretta Miranda, who's just started as the Chief Deputy Tribal Advisor and Special Counsel, if Loretta would like to say a few words.
Hi, greetings everyone. As Christina mentioned, my name is Loretta Miranda, and I am the Chief Deputy Tribal Advisor and Special Counsel for the Governor's Office of the Tribal Advisor. I am a descendant of the Morongo Band of Mission Indians, and I am joining this meeting from the ancestral territory of the Kuya people, and I'm happy to be here.
Thank you, Loretta. And then we're going to go through a round of council introductions. We are going to start with Council Member Manzano, who was unable to join us last meeting, but we'd love to hear a bit about your background and what brings you to the council.
Thank you, Christina. So Hamitach Nitawan Alexis Manzano. Hello, good afternoon. My name is Alexis Manzano, and I'm representing San Manuel as an alternate for the Central Region. I've been a member at large for my tribe's business committee since the summer of 2020. Prior to being elected, I sat as a delegate representative for IHS for the Riverside San Bernardino area, and I was previously the vice chair of our judiciary committee. In regards to my work with other Indigenous nations, I'm currently serving as a North American focal point for the United Nations Global Indigenous Youth Caucus. I am the sole representative for the United States. So this has allowed me to work with numerous Indigenous youth from various nations, organizations, socioeconomic and cultural backgrounds from each of the 7 UN regions. We work together to advocate within the UN framework and outside of that at times. So this position has allowed me to become very familiar with the structuring of UNDRIP, which I believe was touched on day 2 of the last meetings. I have a BA in psychology and a master's in public health, and I'm currently pursuing a dual concentration PhD in public health and Indigenous studies with a research emphasis on human rights and trauma from Claremont Graduate University. I was inspired to sit on this council because something like this is truly inspiring and I think really long overdue. I've been inspired by stories such as colleagues who have participated in the Watongi Tribunal. And from hearing their stories, it made me look into what other countries have done and try to think further about how we can accomplish our own mission here. I'm also inspired by other Indigenous youth who I get to call friends and colleagues. Our current struggles and histories are all really similar in many ways. And of course, I wish to honor our past and our histories and those who came before me who really did endure so much. Without them, we wouldn't be here. I hope what we do here can assist with the healing process. Pertaining to restorative justice, I think this could be a good first step, but policies that could come out of this council are absolutely key. Everyone highlighted in the last meeting really great points, and I'm looking forward to collaborating, sharing, and hearing more from each of you. Success to me means that this council outlives us and becomes long-lasting. Ideally a safe place for California natives to come and speak their truth without the fear of political repercussions naive perhaps, but it is needed. I hope we can achieve and fulfill what our mandate is, elevating the voices of Native nations from our regions and work together with the in-state government and begin the real first steps towards a type of reconciliation. Finally, it's really great to meet you all, and I'm looking forward to working with you all finally.
Thank you, council member, and very excited to have you here. And I think we'll greatly benefit, especially in the space of the youth council discussion. So welcome. If we could have our members introduce themselves before we do a roll call, we'll do it by region. So we'll start with council member Khan.
Good afternoon, everybody. Chairman Kenneth Khan from the San Ynez Band of Chumash Indians. I am here on our traditional territories. It's a pleasure to be here with you all today. I look forward to listening to our brothers and sisters from around the state and working with the council to share truths and also work hard together on moving forward with collaboratively. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Council member Kessler Mata.
Hi, thanks, Christina. So hi, everyone. It's good to see you again. I am Kusla Kessler Mata. I am here on Ohlone territory. I live and work in San Francisco at the University of San Francisco, and I'm representing our Chumash tribe, the Yaktitu Chumash, which is based out of Avila Beach area. And I am also here hoping to help focus on issues related to tribes that lack recognition and helping to partner with the state to make sure we are all protected and moving forward into the future collaboratively with our federally recognized tribes in the state too.
Thank you. Council member
Makaro. Good afternoon. My name is Mark Makaro. I'm the tribal chairman for the Pechanga Band of Luseno Indians in Temecula. And I've been on my tribal council since 1992 and been tribal chair since 1995. And so it's been a while. But this council has been a long time coming in terms of substance, the purpose behind it. So very looking forward very much to engaging in the work here. And then hoping one day we do get at least one meeting in person, maybe down the road. So we'll see how that goes. Thank you.
Thank you. And we will skip over Council Member Manzano unless you want to say a few more words. Okay, you're good. Council Member Burris.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Anthony Burris, and I am a member of Ion Band of Miwok Indians. I've worked with my tribe's culture committee in various forms throughout the years, and I'm currently working with my tribe on NAGPRA issues. And I'm I'm right now on an area that's kind of a border area of Miwok, Nisenan, and Potwin people over here in West Sacramento, kind of on the border of some different areas. So, yeah.
Thank you. And I think congratulations on finishing out some difficult work at school at UC Davis.
Oh, yes. I just finished my qualifying exams. So now I just have to write a dissertation. So.
More challenges.
I still have work to do, but I'm cool with writing. The exam part was a little more nerve wracking because it's typically in graduate school, we're not taking a lot of exams, right? So it's like, oh, okay, I'm back to this now. So, but that's all done. So I'm very excited.
Well, we're happy we could have you join us. It looks like the rest of the Eastern region is not on, but if you are on, please let us know. If you've called in, I believe you can raise your hand. James, what's the dial-in?
Pound 2, if you have dialed in, you can raise your hand.
Pound 2. Okay, so for the Northern region, Council Member Bohorquez.
Ani aiki ma mishistu ingatekarak Isaac Bohorquez. I'm chairman for the Kakuntaruk Band of Ohlone Costanoan Indians at the Big Sur Rancheria. Happy to be here, be a part of it. And like Chairman McCarl said, I'm also looking forward to when we can safely gather in person for a meeting. Thank you. Shuru.
Thank you. Council Member Harper.
Open Nikintosh. I'm Joan Harper, treasurer for the Federated Indians of Great Rancheria here in Rohnert Park. And we are a group of Southern Pomo and Coast Miwok people from Sonoma and Marin County in Northern California. I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Myers.
I please Gwinnaqua, McNow, Frankie Myers, Majumachuk Shregon, Kinnecock, the Vice Chairman for the York Tribe, reporting here from the village of Kinnick on the Yurok Indian Reservation. Welcome.
Thank you. And Council Member Giovanetti.
Delaha, Hagivasham. I'm Joseph Giovanetti, calling in from Eureka, about 65 miles south of Talawa Aboriginal Territory. I'm a longtime tribal council member. 15 years, I guess 14. And I'm a retired academic. I was a 24-year professor, associate professor at Humboldt State, teaching in Native American Studies. I taught a breadth of courses, as happens. I taught about 25 courses over that 24 years, including a million topics, but including issues in genocide against Native Americans. And so one of my particular lifelong passions has been learning about and analyzing everything from day one, from colonization from day one, Francis Drake, all the rest of them, up to the present colonization of our tribes, and the effect of the genocide, specifically the mass reduction, the 90% of elimination of our people from a series of massacres in 1850s and 1860s, and in Northern California, and in fact, all throughout the entire state. We do have that date of 1885 where finally people stopped shooting Indians on the street and just walking by like nothing had happened. I retired in 2018. I continue to be vitally interested in every shred of this history. I've been going through my stuff and compiling my notes and trying to do my best I can to find everything I've put together. And so it's my lifeblood. It's my tribe story. It's our tribe got down to about 110 people in the 1910 federal census. And so the fact that my mother was ever born is a miracle. I was raised by my Native American grandparents in Eureka. They were born in 1899 and 1907. I consider myself very lucky that happened. It was very fortuitous because when I was 5 years old, my Native American grandfather taught me my first history lesson. He said they stole our land, a four-word lesson, which sticks with me to this day. Thank you.
Thank you, council member. And council member Elliot Santos.
Alka Inchwe, Nyaj Angela Elliott Santos, Nyaj Snapatum Kaman. My name is Angela Elliott Santos, and I come from the Manzanita Reservation. I've been on the Tribal Council since 1998. I became the chairwoman in 2015 after we lost my dad, Leroy J. Elliott. I'm very pleased and honored to be part of this truth and healing, and I look forward to all the great things that we're going to do. And I think this is much needed, and I appreciate your office for doing this for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you, council member. But again, I do want to reiterate that this is not something our council is doing. This is something that's been needed for a long time and that the community has expressed needing for a long time. So we appreciate having the opportunity to partner with all of you on it.
Absolutely, but it takes courage to do things that others haven't. So that's where my thank you came from.
Thank you. And Council Member Turner.
Hello, my name is Tishma Turner, and I'm currently serving as the vice chair of the Rincon Band of Luiseno Indians in the San Diego County. I was just reelected to my third term in that position, and my background is higher education and economic development. I have a bachelor's in business and an MBA, and really looking forward to working with all of you. I'm also currently serving on the UC Critical Mission Studies Advisory Council. That is a lot of work, also complementing the work that we're doing here today. So I look forward to working with all of you.
That's great, thank you. And Council Member Phelps.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Robert Phelps. I am from the San Pascual Band of Mission Indians of California. We're just north of Rincon. I am a former vice chairman of the tribe and a former committee chair of various tribal committees. I currently live in the San Francisco Bay Area. I am a professor of history, with especially in California history and the history of the American West at California State University, East Bay. And I'm very happy and pleased to serve this council and will help in whatever capacity the council requires, particularly in regards to my expertise.
Wonderful, thank you. And then as a reminder, nominations for the non-fairly recognized seat in the Southern region are due this evening by 11:59 p.m. We do have some nominations, so I'm not doing this as a last minute trying to get a bunch in, because that would be ridiculous, but 11:59 p.m. And more information on the process and materials needed are available at tribalaffairs.ca.gov/CTHC/nominate. If you want to submit a placeholder nomination while collecting additional materials because you haven't heard of this and you didn't know that it was happening, you can do so. Just let us know that you're going to be submitting those supporting materials so that we can properly follow up on that. So now we will go to the next agenda item, which is a traditional opening, which will have Council Member Macaro.
Love.
Recording stopped.
So I would be remiss if I didn't actually do the roll call. So I'm going to go back to that very quick, even though we know who's here, just for the record. From the Central Region, Council Member Khan.
Present.
Council Member Kesar-Mata.
Present.
Council Member Macaro.
No, Niva, I'm here.
And Council Member Manzano.
Present.
From that region, the three voting members will be the voting members. Eastern Region, Council Member Burris.
Present.
Council Member Perrin. Is not present. Council Member Sisk. Is not present. Council Member Roberts. Is not present. Northern Region, Council Member Mahorquez.
Here.
Council Member Harper.
Present.
Council Member Myers. And Council Member Giovanetti.
Present.
From the Northern Region, all of the voting members will remain the voting members. Southern Region, Council Member Elliot Santos.
Present.
Council Member Turner.
Present.
And Council Member Phelps.
Present.
And Council Member Phelps, you will be designated as a voting member for this meeting. We do have a quorum. We'll now go to agenda item 4, which is the bylaws and process. So as just a quick background, there was some discussion in the last meeting about setting up some sort of process for holding meetings, voting, all of the like. So what I have done is taken a stab at a draft bylaws. The council can choose to adopt bylaws or not. These bylaws, just for some clarity, are based on some of the bylaws that I developed for the Tribal Nation Grant Fund, which is also an all-tribal member panel that is not constricted by certain state laws. And so it was drafted with an eye toward not constraining tribal processes or decision-making processes, but was modified for this council. Heavily modified for this council. if it's okay with the council, I will go through those bylaws, which for those of you that are viewing via CalSpan or Zoom, those are available at tribalaffairs.ca.gov/CTHC/meetings at the materials part of that page for the February 26th meeting, and it's entitled Draft Bylaws. Is it acceptable if I share my screen and go through those? Okay. Sorry, I have a little bit of a different setup in my home office, so it takes just a second. Okay. Can everybody see this okay? If you're nodding, I can't.
Yes, we see it.
Thank you.
I see it.
So what we'll do and what I'm proposing to do is that we'll go through these bylaws so that everyone has a chance to see them in real time, so that you don't have to spend time outside of the meeting going through it, at least at this point. If you have any edits or additions, we'll take those edits now or comments to Chairman McCarl.
Yeah, when you're done with, I just want to add one thing.
Okay. As we go through, we'll do any copy edits or comments so that we can go back and do edits. The members of the council and members of the public can also submit comments and edits. And I'm recommending that the council take this to kind of think about it a bit for consideration at the next meeting if there's any amendments or action on it. That's assuming you want to have bylaws. If not, we can not waste our time and we can keep moving. So, Councilmember McCarl?
Just on that last point, I do feel we do need bylaws, although the less time we spend on this and more on the substance of our council, the better. What I wanted to say is that I think you may have said it, but in case you didn't, we did spend some time at the previous meeting doing a run through of this as well. And I think there may have even been a motion in place, but it was deferred and additional time was given. So here we are. But at least for the record, I wanted to make sure we noted that. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Any other council comment before we dive in? Okay, so I'm just gonna read through. So these are the draft bylaws. The definitions in the general provisions are alternate voting member. It means the four alternate tribal leaders and representatives from the Central, Eastern, Northern, and Southern regions, respectively, duly appointed by the tribal advisor and the governing council, pursuant to Executive Order N-1519, to vote in the event that a voting member of the governing council from the same region is unable to vote for any reason. Sorry, we're doing live edits here. The central region means tribes located within the jurisdiction or within the geographical region of the state within the exterior geographical boundaries of Riverside, San Bernardino, Orange, Los Angeles, San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara, and Ventura counties. Charter means the California Truth and Healing Council charter duly adopted by the governing council in December 2020. Council or council members means the governing council and any non-voting representatives duly appointed or elected by the governing council. Eastern region means the tribes located within the eastern geographical region of the state within the exterior geographical boundaries of Alpine and the following counties. Governing council means the body of tribal leaders and representatives duly appointed by the tribal advisor pursuant to Executive Order N-1519 and the charter as voting and alternate voting members of the council. So that's this body here, to differentiate from other folks that might be added later. Northern region means the tribes located within the northern geographical region of the state within the exterior geographical boundaries of these counties. Office of the Tribal Advisor means the office headed by the governor's tribal advisor within the office of the governor, established pursuant to section 12012.3 of the government code, which shall provide administrative support to the council. Southern region means the tribes located within the, southern geographical region of the state within the exterior geographical boundaries of Imperial and San Diego counties. Staff means the Office of Tribal Advisor and any other personnel or contractors secured to assist the council in its work. The Tribal Advisor is the governor's tribal advisor established pursuant to this section of the government code. And a voting member means the 12 tribal leaders and representatives duly appointed by the tribal advisor to the governing council pursuant to Executive Order N-1519 and the charter to direct the work of the council. Powers and duties. The governing council shall have all of the powers and duties specified in N-1519 and Chapter 3 of the charter and shall direct the work of the council. Governing members, council members shall attend all regular and non-regular meetings of the council. That needs to be capitalized. The council shall have the powers and duties as specified in N-1519 and Chapter 3 of the charter, and council members shall attend all regular meetings of the council. Tribal advisor shall have the powers and duties under the executive order and the charter and shall perform all duties under the direction of the council and will coordinate the work of staff as necessary to facilitate the regular work of the council. The tribal advisor shall also arrange all meetings of the council in coordination with staff. I'm going to pause. Do we have any edits beyond the copy edits I just had? Or any comments? Okay, I'll keep moving. And just for clarity, I'll send the amended draft with any of the copy edits back out and repost it to the website for folks to use as their working draft. Appointment to the council. The tribal advisor shall appoint the members of the governing council in accordance with the provisions of this article and chapter 2, articles 3 and 4 of the charter. The governing council shall consist of the 12 voting members as specified in the charter and 4 alternate voting members from central, eastern, northern, and southern regions, respectively. All appointed members of the governing council shall be duly elected officials or appointed designees of California Native American tribes on the list maintained by the Native American Heritage Commission. Some of this is pulled from the charter, but is duplicated just for the use of the council, or just for ease of use and clarity. Non-voting representatives. The governing council may, upon a majority vote of quorum present, or, and this is an option for you, that's why it's highlighted, or upon the vote of 8 members of the governing council authorized to vote, which is, that's also the amount needed for quorum, so it's basically everybody, appoint non-voting representatives to council, which may include representatives of state and local agencies or relevant non-governmental stakeholders and experts. Non-voting representatives shall be appointed under such terms, conditions, and duration as adopted by the governing council. Are there any thoughts on this piece? Councilmember Kessler Mata.
Hi, yeah, thanks, Christina, for noting this one. I have to say, I do have quite a few reservations about including this in the bylaws. I can see why in the future we may want to incorporate it. And based on what I read later, if we should want to adjust the bylaws, it's basically a majority vote and we could, you know, bring it back then. But just my kind of political science right hat tells me this type of provision tends to be a backdoor to right kind of particular interest and can be manipulated. It's the most easily convoluted part of the bylaws, which by the way are excellent. It's just this one particular part raises some red flags for me.
Would you be able to clarify a bit more on this piece?
Sure. So we have, you know, I try and think about what would an expert or a non-governmental organization, why would they need to be incorporated into the bylaws or into the council itself, right? that's the part I'm just not sure what the purpose or function of that is. I can see, we have later talking about subcommittees, I can see incorporating some of those types of folks as parts of the subcommittee for like referencing to them or partnering with them, but I don't necessarily see the value in adding them as constitutive members of the council itself.
Okay, would it be okay to keep the section and then strike the makeup? The makeup is included in the executive order, and that's more of just a capture-all language to say who's allowed to be there. They don't have to be, and that's at the direction of this council. But we can strike this in the bylaws if this is the concerning part of it, just to create a mechanism for appointing other people.
Right, but I guess what I'm saying is that I'd rather create the mechanism later. It's in the same language in the executive order, so it says may as well in the executive order. It's still, you know, it's rather than bring it, because actually removing the agents, the specific agents, doesn't have the effect of changing the substantive component, which is that we can add council, you know, member, we can expand the council. So if we want to do that, then fine, but I think we have to have a more fuller discussion about that. But I saw that Chairman Macaro had his hand up as well.
And before we get to Chairman Macaro, the one, you are already authorized to add people under the bylaw, I mean, under the charter. So you don't necessarily need more clarification given that you can act on a majority vote regardless, but just clarifying that piece. Council Member Macaro.
First of all, can you slide the page back onto the screen? Disappeared when you opened the red line section changes. Okay. So essentially this section is talking about adding people other than us, but in particular representatives of state and local agencies or relevant non-governmental stakeholders and experts. I mean, it could be anything from a county supervisor to I don't know, a member of a local water board or an anthropologist, perhaps. And you said it, this verbiage is in, it's a question. This verbiage is in the executive order. Is that right?
This is in the executive order, and it was included in there to allow for the council to have flexibility to bring on other people who were non-tribal or who were tribal but not part of the original body.
No, okay. Appreciate that clarification. I want to thank Kusla for flagging this. I think her point is well taken, and I would support that at least in time. Perhaps we will want to incorporate this. Now, though, it doesn't feel right. We're trying to get up and running, and I think as a group of council members on this Truth and Healing Council, we need to establish some cohesiveness amongst us, you know. I'll encapsulate these entities under my own. I understand these as like third parties to what we're doing, and third parties may be wholly supportive of what we're doing. But we need our voice to come through. We need our authenticity to be at least to set our direction in these early days of this council. And so, to the extent that you know, we may need that. Specialty expertise a little ways down the road. I can see why it's in the executive order as well as here. And I would support keeping it in here, but whatever the mechanism is that defers incorporating it into our council is what I would support along the lines of what Council Member Kusla was stating. Thank you.
Thank you. So what I can do, and let me open up my video so I can see more faces. If the council is okay with it, I'll strike all of this and just keep the reserved language in the event, or I can strike the whole section if you think it's opening too much of a door for future. Council Member Macaro.
Yeah, I would support reserving it for now. I don't want to completely foreclose on it. Sometimes, look, the practical side of what we're doing here is sometimes third parties, maybe even third parties that are not Indians, are the only people that academia will listen to or something like that. I mean, we've encountered that. We still encounter that. So there are third parties out there, like I said, are supportive of our way of thinking and what it is we're trying to do, we may need them in alliance down the road. So reserving it seems prudent to do, and I would support that rather than foreclosing completely on it. Thank you.
Great. And then Councilmember Bohorquez, did you have something to add on this piece or something else?
No, I was just going to say, yeah, I think reserving it, and just to, in my understanding, and you mentioned it, and just to clarify, I guess, for myself, we still have the ability through the subcommittees and other methods through the charter to obviously to be able to act and bring other representatives in. So
absolutely.
Not so. Just clarification for me. I would say, yes, let's reserve it.
Okay, so I'm going to look at people's heads now. Is it okay if I just strike this whole section and then reserve it? Okay, nodding yes for those who are listening in. So I'm going to go ahead and do that right now. And then I'm just going to strike the comments. Okay. Anything else on that? Well, it's gone. So we'll keep moving. Removal. Members of the governing council may be removed in accordance with the charter. And that's just to bring that back in for reference here. And then I'm going to just strike this section since there's nothing that speaks to it above. Meeting procedures. For regular meetings, the council shall meet a minimum of 4 times a year in accordance with this article of the charter. And that charter also has the encouragement of meeting in the different regional locations for each meeting so that you are guaranteed once we're in non-COVID times to have different locations. And then regular meeting dates and times shall be approved during the meeting immediately preceding each regularly scheduled meeting. And that was at the suggestion too of Council Member Myers. Non-regular meetings. A non-regular meeting may be called by the tribal advisor at any time or by the governing council at any time upon the request of 3 or more members of the governing council. Notice of the time, place, and purpose of any meeting scheduled outside of the regular meeting shall comply with all laws applicable to the business of the council. That's a kind of an all capture-all for any open meeting laws. Quorum for transaction of business. All voting members of the governing council are authorized to vote on actions taken by the council. Alternate voting members shall not be authorized to vote on actions taken by the council unless a voting member of the governing council from the same region is unable to vote for any reason. That language is there for the event that someone needs to recuse themselves. I'm not quite sure what the business of the council is going to be, but there could be conflicts. Or if someone is not able to come, we don't want to, you know, people should be able to do their own thing and not have to justify it unless someone's gone for over a year and then we may have to remove them just because of that. But for the duration that a voting member of the governing council is unable to vote for any reason, the alternate voting member from the same region shall be authorized to vote. So that would be pending the recusal or, you know, pending the appointment of a member as in the southern region. Provided, however, that no alternate voting member shall be authorized to vote on behalf of a voting member from a different geographical region. This clause I included to account for the regional diversity, which was very intentional, and to maintain that regional mix so that also you don't end up having, you know, half of the state voting one way and kind of moving things in a direction that might not be. Okay, I'll stop explaining because you're all nodding. You already understand. 8 governing council members who are authorized to vote are required to establish a quorum, and that's under the charter. The governing council may take action by a majority vote of a quorum in accordance with the charter. And so that's any time you have a motion. In the absence of a quorum, the business of the meeting shall be tabled until the next regular meeting of the council, and the governing council members present or the tribal advisor may adjourn pursuant to this article below, or proceed with a public listening session with no action taken by the governing council members present. So this is to account for the fact that under Bagley-Keene, you can't actually start a meeting without quorum. So what would happen is it would automatically be pushed, all of the business would be pushed to the next meeting. And then you could either adjourn the meeting or you could convert it to a public listening session, which I would probably most of the time recommend, just so that people who set aside their time would have some time to engage. I'll keep moving unless there are comments. Okay. Adjournment or cancellation when quorum cannot be established. The tribal advisor may adjourn a meeting when quorum cannot be established unless a majority of the governing council members present agree to proceed with a public listening session. The tribal advisor may, in advance of a meeting, cancel or reschedule such meeting when the governing when governing council member attendance responses indicate that a quorum will not be established. When canceling or rescheduling a meeting under this section, the tribal advisor shall provide the council and the public with written notice a minimum of 3 days in advance of the meeting. The agenda items for any meeting adjourned or canceled due to lack of quorum shall carry over to the next scheduled regular meeting of the council. Minutes. The tribal advisor, in coordination with staff, shall prepare minutes of each council meeting. The council's approval of meeting minutes shall establish conclusively that such minutes are accurately reflect actions taken by the council at that meeting. The contents of the minutes shall contain all actions taken by the council, and the tribal advisor shall make any minutes or shall make minutes available to the council a minimum of 10 days in advance of the meeting at which the vote to approve them will take place. Agenda for council meetings. The tribal advisor, in coordination with staff, shall prepare an agenda for each meeting in consultation with the governing council. Issues not on the agenda that are raised during a meeting may carry over to the next agenda or for discussion and or official action upon the recommendation of the governing council. And then the business of the council shall be conducted in accordance with the principles and spirit of Robert's Rules of Order, subject to the governing documents of this council and any applicable laws, regulations, policies, or procedures. So this is so that you have some baseline order without having this look like Parliament. And then procedure for amendment is that you can amend these bylaws upon a majority vote, and that amendments that are proposed will be made available at least 10 days in advance of the meeting at which the vote to amend will take place. I'll now stop sharing and open for discussion.
Christina? Mm-hmm. That last sentence about 10 days, is that standard in state speak, state process?
It's not. It's something that I've had requested from other bodies, that they'd like to have anything that they're going to vote on 10 days in advance.
Okay. I'm okay with it. I just didn't know if it was trying to mirror a state rule or something. Okay, thank you.
We can take it out. I'm okay, but I think it's better for this council if you have 10 days in advance.
If somebody wants to push it one way or the other, I'll listen to that.
Councilmember Kessler-Mata.
Thanks. Yeah, quick question. So under the non-regular voting meeting rules, so logistically, it would be hard if we're not able to communicate with each other to like let other people know that, hey, let's call a meeting, right? logistically, I'm wondering if, as the facilitator of this, if you or whoever is helping staff can call a meeting or let everyone else know that someone has asked to call a meeting, such that, and then see if anyone else wants to support that move, kind of just to actually facilitate the process in case there's a need for a non-regular meeting.
Sure. We can absolutely do that. And also we can, on our initiative, take, just call it at the request of even one member. But we can do that as we get requests if it's outside of a regular meeting. Yeah. And then I think part of this is, if you in this meeting decide you want to have another meeting, we just want everybody to kind of concur. Okay. But yes, we can do that. That's the short answer.
Okay. And the only other thing I was going to ask is it possible for us, and I think it would be Article 3G under agenda, think about incorporating the call for the agenda being either consistent with the same period of the meeting minutes. So when they're sent out, we could get a call for the agenda items and then maybe see an agenda a few days before in advance, or is that, or meeting materials?
So if we did it in accordance with the timing on the others, it would be, we'd be running up against Bagley Keene. So what we can do is we'll call for agenda items no later than, we'll do it at the end of each meeting, and then we'll do it also no later than 14 days before. So that way it can be okay. And then we can prepare any items if we need them.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll incorporate that too. And then any of these comments and incorporations, what I'll do is add that and then circulate to this group this afternoon, I think, so that you can make additional comments and notes before. I'm not looking at my screen right now, but are there any other additional comments or discussion from the council on this item?
I have one, Christine.
Yes, Councilmember Myers.
I actually had two. Just to be clear, we're talking business days or calendar days, just to be specific?
Calendar.
Cool.
I can specify that in all of the days too.
I'm getting into my bylaw mode. The other one I was thinking or wondering, we don't have, we're not dealing in finances or funding or budgeting, but do we need to call out that we'll create financial procedures?
Let me look into that. I think we'll put a pin in it because this council doesn't have to do anything at this point. But it could be that some of these, like for example, if you do create a subcommittee on funding and private partnerships, that may need to start thinking about that. Given that this is part of a governor's order, it could be like if we have requests for funding, that might have to go through the behested payment process, which is basically if the governor ever asks anybody for funding, it has to have all of this paperwork. And so as an officer of the governor, I have to do that as well. And this body might have to do that. So I think that is a wonderful thing to flag and not complicated at all. But we'll put it in through legal and make sure that we run that down before any of that happens. So thanks. And I'll put a hold in that and a note so that we look into that.
That's good. Thank you.
Any additional comments at this time? Or are there any additional procedures at this time that this council would find helpful? Or shall we just move forward and then flag them as we go, kind of like with the financial procedures? Keep it moving is what I'm seeing. Okay, we'll keep moving.
Christina?
Yes?
Are we taking any public comment at this point in time?
We will. So what we'll do is we'll open up for public comment on this agenda item. Again, remember that this is specific to this agenda item and you'll have 3 minutes to provide public comment. For the council, because it's on the agenda, you can discuss it. If it's not something on the agenda, you cannot discuss it. So let's go.
Okay, so there's one hand raised, Annette Cordero. Annette, you should be able to unmute yourself.
Yes, it's Antoinette. My item is just on the minutes and it's very minor, but I just, where it says the content, the tribal advisor shall make the minutes available to the council in a minimum of 10 days. Can we also say, and the public, because in many cases, the minutes will reflect public comments that were made at your meetings as well. Members of the public may need to review them to make sure that they're accurate as well.
I don't see why not, unless the council has any concerns with that. Okay, it looks like no concerns, so we can do that. We can incorporate that as well.
As long as they're clearly marked as draft.
We put draft on everything at the state, so.
That's last public hand raised.
Okay, perfect. So we will then move along to the next item. Okay, this item is more of a discussion, I think, for the council, but is on scope. There was some discussion at the last meeting about how to limit scope. This could be a very long conversation, or you might want more information, but I'm going to open it up to the council. I do want to very quickly, sorry, I'm trying to multitask on taking these notes too. But I do want to very quickly just kind of get the discussion started with some background and then open it to the council for the actual discussion on this. For context, the executive order was drafted with the idea that you know, because it was kind of a one-sided drafting process, we wanted to make sure that it was as open-ended as possible for this council to decide the direction that you all wanted to go in the focus. That said, it was intended to be something that accounted for the historical acts of the state that the intentional genocidal acts and funding and anything that came from that. So it was intended to be at the creation of the state. And then once the incorporation of recommendations for reparation and restoration were included, it was intended to be linking some of those historical acts to what we're seeing today and think about how to remedy that. So with that overarching principle, the time period under examination, this council can think about being shorter or longer, but it was intended to be historical. And just given the scope of how big the state is, how many diverse cultural groups there are, how many different things are now in place as a product of this very early action, it will be already a very big feat covering, let's say, the first 50 years of statehood. But I do want to just give that context. You are not bound by anything I'm saying right now. I'm just giving you a bit of guidance. And I did want to point to part of the inspiration for this was the Advisory Council on California Indian Policy that was done in the US Congress. And the way that they split up, and basically for context, for those of you that are unaware, and we can post all of the report on the website as well for people to look at their leisure, because you don't have to make decisions yet. This is only the second meeting, and there's a lot to get through. But for background, that council investigated the status of California Indians in the 90s, but went from a historical context and kind of did an overview up to present. It looked mostly at the federal government's obligations and where they were lacking in meeting those obligations, and then also the federal government's part in that space. Part of the thought behind the state doing something similar would be to cover the state's half of that, because the state was complicit, and the state at a certain point was supposed to take on a lot of responsibilities that I shouldn't be saying on live stream, but I'm going to say it anyway, that may not have been taken on. And so that was kind of the overarching frame in the thinking of doing this kind of work from the state side. But we put this on the council to think through. But so it may be worth looking to something like the Advisory Council on California Indian Policy Report as kind of an overarching framework to guide some of the work. That report has divided California history into certain eras, basically. And the one era that I think is most relevant, at least for this council's work in terms of the creation of the state, is basically the American period, if I can find the tab. The American period in California, which they are denoting as 1850 to 1900. That could be kind of a plus or minus, depending on where you're looking. You could look at the discovery of the unratified treaties as the end marker, or you could go out a little further, even to the IRA in 1934. In the 1800s, you're covering, the discovery of gold, which very soon thereafter, America then determined that California must become an American state, coincidentally, and then very proactively started doing a lot of really destructive legal actions. So for example, UC Hastings has reached out because Hastings did a lot of the legal justification for divesting California Native people of their lands and repudiating any sort of Spanish land grants and the like. It covers loss of land and cultures and justifying putting bounties on Native people's heads. It covers due process issues, slavery or indentured servitude issues, the inability to appear before the courts or become a lawyer or speak in front of the courts. And it goes all the way up to some of the boarding school era removals of children. So it's a very awful, awful period of time. And unfortunately, that period did not end. So if this council wants to go beyond that and go beyond, up to maybe the Indian Reorganization Act period, that could be acceptable too. I think it's about figuring out how much, or if this council does become a more long-term council, if you'd like to do this in historical phases. So that's some background. That report focused on federal recognition, termination, community services, economic development, trust in natural resources, Indian education, cultural preservation, and Indian health. Those are pretty good. but again, just wanted to give you all some background on that. And it may be that you want to think about this a bit more or take a look at that report. How, at least from my limited viewpoint, I see this work being done is a focus on capturing the historical record, both what all of you think is acceptable statewide as being the version of reality that you're behind in the beginnings of the state, plus the oral testimony that will be gathered through the consultation process for each of the tribes and then also throughout listening sessions. And that all has a budget to be transcribed. So even if it's not incorporated into the final report in full, all of those transcriptions at the agreement of the folks speaking will be available in archive format. So there's the historical piece, and then there's the piece that links it to modern day injustices, and that's the piece about recommendations for restoration and reparation. So it seems that there's probably two focuses of here is the thing that happened, and here is where it's at today. That is just a very preliminary kind of thought process to organize maybe how you might think about it, but again, you could go in a different direction. You could scrap it all. I'm going to stop talking and kind of open it up to council, or you can also table this item and think about it more and go back out to listening sessions if you'd like. And I will say you don't have to make all of these decisions at once. You can start the work of the council and based on what you're receiving, you can start thinking a bit more clearly about how you want to think about it. Similar to what we heard from the Maine Wabanaki folks who, got a lot of just raw testimony and then kind of sorted it out on the back end. We could also arrange for some folks to come speak with the council. I know Loretta Toole has offered to talk about that specific process with the advisory council since she was a part of it. But again, we'll leave it to this council to discuss. Council Member McCarl.
Only if you're done. Okay. The suggestion of trying to box in our scope, I think, in logic is a good one. I'm not so sure in practice it's something we should necessarily, you know, look at hard and fast. First of all, I had a question about the advisory council report. I think was one of the deliverables there. What was the end date or the publication date of that report?
They finalized their publication in 1997, and I think they had to ask for a few extensions on it as well.
Have you seen well, I guess you have seen the end result of that because you were quoting part of it. It's like a thick hardcover book about this big like that, right?
And it sits on a lot of shelves.
It was quite the tour de force. It took a long time. Its genesis was in the 1980s. My recollection of its intent was to be a tool to underscore the historical underfunding by Congress in appropriations for California tribes. California tribes had been it was recognized and argued in the mid to late 1980s, and certainly before that, that relative to the big land-based tribes elsewhere in the United States and tribes throughout Indian country, that California was the worst of the worst in terms of funding from Congress. And so that report was intended to historically demonstrate, I mean, in part anyway, historically demonstrate that that was true, and also show some of the practices, institutional practices and things of creatures of state law and whatnot that led to that circumstance. In the end, it probably was too much because it was unfocused and, most members of Congress need a one-page document in front of them that gets to the point real quick. And, this was our history of collective history of California. So, but it is, I think, a good starting point for, I agree, it's a pretty good starting point as much as anything else might be for our discussion. I just want to, I think 1850 is a pretty decent place to start or thereabouts because of, September 9th. And California becoming a state in that year. I do quarrel a bit with the 1900 date being the bookend date for that, because there's so many things that occurred after that that I think California is either complicit in or was a party to undermining tribes, destabilizing tribes, continuing the dispossession of tribes. I mean, I'll just name three. There was the eviction of the Indians from Cupa Village and other neighboring villages in 1902, aided by Governor Downey and the United States Army. It was a favor to Warner. Then in, I think it was the 1930s or maybe thereabouts, it was the removal of the Indians of the Capitan Grande Indian Reservation, which dispossessed long established villages there that became, existing reservations. But that was in the 1930s, just to build a San Vicente Reservoir. And even in 1953, I would regard the establishment of Public Law 280 as a diminishment of tribal authority, and tribes had no say in that. The federal government handed over jurisdiction to the state, and the state accepted an unfunded mandate, to be sure, but tribes had no voice in that. And, we're still wrestling with that decades later, the consequences of having have that just essentially forced on us. So there's just three examples of, why it makes sense to go beyond 1900. Anyway, thank you.
Councilmember McCraw. Next, we had Councilmember Giovanetti raise his hand.
Yeah, I wanted to say in this regard to I think it's the ACCIP report we're talking about, right?
I think so.
I think that's the acronym. I was going to add that that there was a substantial federal recognition component to that report too, and it is a very lengthy report, and that because one of the principal authors of that report, the late Al Logan Slagle, who taught at Bolt Law School, he was an enrolled Catua Cherokee from Oklahoma. He worked with somewhere between 15 and 20 unrecognized California tribes. Actually, a lot of the work he did might be of some use to our council, because I think his records or his archives are housed at UC Davis in one of their libraries. And also, I've noticed over the last 10 years or so that congressmen and congresswomen are so busy that they kind of they don't fully embrace the complexity, not impossibility or the inherent unfairness of federal recognition, which has scarcely been touched by a Congress since 1977, with one modification, I think. And so they ordinarily will say, well, why don't you just propose a bill recognizing tribes X, Y, and Z in your state? And, you know, that's like, I don't know, it's like trying to thread something through a needle that's almost impossible. I just wanted to add that.
Thank you, council member. Yeah, I think in part of this, there's a lot that this council could do on thinking through how to make the process at the federal level a bit better, but that's probably for a later time. Council member, I thought I had a raised hand from council member Phelps, if you wanted to.
I just can add to it very quickly. I mean, history doesn't stop, really. And so I think it's artificial to say, okay, we'll go to, you know, to 1900, to 1945, something to that effect. It just doesn't stop. It continues. You know, and I think it would require some thinking, but perhaps it would be better to deal with 1850. Yes, we can start there because of the legal creation of the state of California. But stopping at a certain date seems to me to be really artificial, and perhaps we could deal with issues topically. But that would require a lot of thought about exactly how we would structure those topics. And that was all I was going to say.
Council member, and I think too, this is a real opportunity for this council to frame that kind of thinking too, which I think is not that the Western compartmentalized type of thinking. So I think if you frame it appropriately, it could be a way to kind of change the way people think about history and the passage of time and legacies. So anyway, I think I saw council member Sisk was next.
Yeah, I also wanted to, I agree with the last speaker on that time frame, because I think as a council, we need to think about not only the California report, but the California claims case that didn't end until the early 70s. And all of the California Indians were recognized by that claims case. And we got services for 10 years. When the California report went in, the actual California budget for Indians in California was greatly reduced and only went to those listed on the federal acknowledgement list. And since that time, the unrecognized tribes who had roll numbers and were receiving services, who then were told you need to apply to get those same services, ended. And I think that's part of the situation that creates a lot of the injustice and the need for healing that stems from no representation. The California Indians that are not on those lists of those, you know, and it's very unfair that the adult Indian communities that were rancherias that was created for that were just given tribal acknowledgement, even though we're all related to them, but we didn't get tribal acknowledgement. And so I think that the time frame, you know, needs to go as far as it goes. You know, it's like unrecognized tribes have been doing without any kind of support systems since the 70s. And, you know, I don't think they can survive more decades of not even being able to apply for anything that that is Indians and not being able to use the acts of Congress that apply to the Indians. You know, those are real injustices. And so I don't think we should have a cutoff date when things are just piled upon things. Yep. Okay.
Thank you, council member. And then I think I saw council member Myers next.
Yeah, thank you for that, Christina. I won't keep going on about the extent of the time. But to say, I absolutely agree that it goes even to today, but I do like breaking things up into manageable chunks, doable tasks that can be accomplished, and looking through a lens that you can focus on. I think having, you know, our history broken up into, you know, pieces or sections so that we can go through and really tell a coherent story is important. So I agree with moving forward with that as well, and starting from the, you know, the furthest back and moving forward also makes sense in storytelling. And I think it also makes sense in telling the truth about California as well. One of the opportunities that was afforded in the last few months is to have a conversation with a friend of mine from New Zealand about the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions that happened down there. It was a fantastic conversation. I would recommend hearing a presentation from them, from the committee. I think, you know, we can go so many different directions with this group. This could be, you know, very academically driven. This could be legally driven. Or as we've heard before, this could be a process to heal emotionally as a people. I do really appreciate what they did down in that hemisphere. I appreciated listening and hearing the processes that they went through to, you know, first document the wrongs and be clear with the history before moving forward. You know, I'm really wrapping my head around that being pretty critical to us moving forward, is to have not only a clear history of tribes in California, but a history that everyone agrees on and recognizes as the actual history of what happened. And so I would move to think that we should maybe start thinking about that as task one, or assign one of our groups to begin, you know, breaking. I mean, we're already in sections, right? We already have these like four designations. We don't have to do more than that. But then, you know, starting, I would start 1845, but you know, wherever you want to start. And then we kind of go for 50-year chunks up until the future, or up until now, and go from there. But I think I rambled there for a little bit. Hopefully there was something coherent there. Thank you.
Thank you. I think that was really helpful, Councilmember Myers. I would say that hearing all of this input, it sounds like what you could do, and we can discuss this in the next item, is even create subcommittees based on issue area that starts where you want to start and ends where you want to end. And so it would be both, let's say that it's, you know, natural resources, and you look at the impacts of mining and blasting to, you know, water populations and you know, even ongoing mercury levels for tribal communities. That could be one space where that history is, you know, that's different from everything else. And then you can kind of bring it back to the body and then incorporate that into the bigger narrative for the collective history. So what you could do is establish subcommittees of two from different regions that can lead that work outside of this bigger body. But we can talk about that at the next agenda item. But I think that was helpful. And that way you're also covering both the history, and then you're getting the input, and then you're also getting some regional stuff, because you're going to be working on regional levels too. I'll stop talking. Council Member Kessler-Mata had her hand raised.
Yeah, so I'm struggling with a couple of things in terms of how to frame and cover all of this, but I do want to say that I think a subcommittee idea is great. I think we do, you know, especially for unrecognized tribes along the coast in the mission region, you know, wherever there are missions, it's even, you know, even farther back, right? So we see that we have to think about how the missions impacted the location of a lot of tribes and then what constitutes now tribal homelands today, right? So if you're displaced because you were moved to a mission and then, you know, brought together with a lot of other tribes and then after the fact released, right, to no man's land because, right, we became the homeless Indians of California. Like all of that history can, you know, is it has a very long arc. And I understand that, so this is, I struggle with that with the same time that we acknowledge that this is for about the state, right? So this is supposed to be about the state of California. So historically, right, if we did compartmentalize again on this kind of linear timeframe, we can account for some of these things. But I really think the focus has to be on the state, especially if when we think about recommendations, you know, whatever, three years in or something, and we're really looking at concrete recommendations, the recommendations that I think are going to be most likely to be tenable are going to have to do with the state, right? So when we think about judicial apparatus in California, what has that role of the court system been in, you know, treating both individual Indians as well as California tribes, right? What's that relationship been like historically? So we could either use, right, frame this whole thing by looking at what does that state apparatus look like and how has its relationships existed with tribes over the course of history, at the same time that we have a historical narrative that we kind of all support and agree on that maybe starts long time ago, really long time, and then up to, you know, the present day. So that is to say, I like the idea of the Councilmember Phelps mentioned about topical, right? But I think those topics might be able to be thought of as relationships with the state, right, and to some extent. And then we can also have a historical narrative that we develop and kind of all agree on, because one, I mean, I'm not a historian. I don't feel like that's my forte, but, and I know there's people out there that have done the ethnographic work. We have a lot of California natives who are now professors and scholars throughout the state. They're the experts. You know, we can work with them and then help, you know, we can build that report. I don't think, right, ACCIP may be the starting point, but that's not, I'm not thinking, we're not going to be receiving testimony from people who were in the mission system. We're going to be receiving testimony from people who are, right, have been today presently impacted by the legacy of the mission system. And those are different things, right? So we can do the historical work separately from the testimony. Anyway, I should clarify that, but I'm not going to. We got more hands.
No, I think that was wonderful, Councilmember. And one thing for this council to think about to add some more complexity is that, you know, the American era didn't, it wasn't alone in just popping up. It incorporated things that were already in place. And Native people hid in places like Russian forts and in other places. And that's how some of the land got divvied out to homeless Indians later. So it's all connected in a way, which makes this like an incredibly complicated task. But I do think there are a lot of tribes here that would want to explore the mission system and how the state has incorporated it by reference almost. But
Councilmember Macaro? Yeah, I wanted to underscore a couple of things that I heard as well. I think Councilmember Sisk mentioned at the U.S. Claims Commission, or at least I think that's where you were going, but I think you said it. This has been a fascinating discussion already, by the way. Just to point out, I think in my head, I'm thinking, you know, topical or issue area versus, you know, historical or chronological thinking at this point. And to underscore that, so Councilwoman Sisk mentioned that the Claims Court, the Claims Commission. So, you know, that that entire activity, I guess, for lack of a better term in my head at the moment, is, you know, it started about 1905 and 1906, you know, when somebody in the U.S. Senate, I guess, opened the drawer and found all these treaties, 18 treaties from California that had been secretly voted on and then put in that drawer for almost 50 years. And so that began that whole epoch of, the U.S. Claims Commission and the court proceedings that ends probably in the 1960s, or really in 1972 with the last judgment roll. All those things in between. California was a key player in that, is complicit in representing us tribes in court, by the way, at one point, and also, you know, diminishing our lands, diminishing who we were, diminishing all kinds of things. So, you know, that's something that we're establishing a timeline makes no sense, because that the whole trajectory took place between 1905 and 1972, but is still reverberating. But, you know, the genesis of that, of course, began with the treaties themselves in 1851, 1852. So that's one example. And another, you know, it's going to be hard not to deal with the missions, because even though, you know, that started in the late 1700s for Alta California, if you want to use that term, in the United States Capitol, sitting there, which I think that's behind Joe there, you have California's representatives, or representative statues and statuary hall in the U.S. Capitol is Junipero Serra. You know, what the hell is that? Excuse me. You know, that should not be there. And every day that's there, most days that pops into my head that's such an injustice, that of all the people in California that could be represented in that hall, and in a state with 40 million people in it, that's the one person that's in statuary hall right now. Now, it's not the first time somebody's argued that that's a thing, but, you know, the decision-making that went into that little thing is an injustice too, and needs correction. And, you know, that just adds insult to injury. So, you know, in our first meeting, I think I mentioned something that, like, we need to come up with those things that California needs to be sorry for, and move forward from that, just to put it really kind of simplistically. And so, you know, there are things that were right in history and things that were wrong. Some of those things that were wrong might be regarded by people as smaller things, and other things are bigger wrongs. And so no need to sort that out right now, other than to, you know, things that are in the wrong column are things that likely need to be addressed, because they affect the lives of our people. We've got kids now, you know, that have to encounter, if they go there to U.S. Capitol, see Father Serra there and ask why. So just that's a real present day example that's tied to something that took place, you know, in the 1700s. So just wanted to point that out. Thank you.
Thank you, council member. And I really like that idea of organizing it based on what does California need to be sorry for, and then kind of going from there, because that also links to Councilmember Kessler-Mata's suggestion of looking at California structures and looking at that. Councilmember Giovanetti?
Yeah, I want to say that, adding a little bit to what Councilmember McCarroll just said about the acts of Congress at the time of the hiding of the California unratified treaties, once those 18 treaties have been negotiated by late 1851, that when word got out that the California delegation in Congress in the Senate was proposing to set aside 7.5 million acres of land to the Indian tribes in California, that there was such a blowback that they succumbed to the pressure and they took a vote to hide those treaties for 50 years. And so Councilmember McCarroll addressed that a second ago. I wanted to say another reason among a multiplicity of reasons for that kind of makes it a challenge to maybe have 1900 as a cutoff. There's so many things in the 20th century and up till now that deal with the disempowerment of our tribes, the marginalization of tribal sovereignty. And I was thinking about Attila Hardwick tribe in my region. I won't say who this is because they have their own story that they could tell it better than I can. But in the early 80s, I'm aware of a situation where a BIA official did not agree with a headcount that a tribal chairperson had submitted to an area office of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. This is one of the 18 Tilly Hardwick tribes that had been recognized at the end of that litigation. And the BIA official got riled up. I was told this by a scholar who is a witness to this whole story. The BIA official got riled up and threatened to pull the federal recognition of that newly recognized Tilly Hardwick tribe. And this was all over the issue of a small rancheria submitting names for federal funding for of Indians who are 1/8 blood. That's interesting. So the blood quantum thing being used as a saber and being rattled in the faces of just tribes just clawing, just fighting to reestablish themselves. I think about that as a great injustice, and that never really saw the light of day, that story. Those kinds of stories, they need to be told somehow, and it need to be, you know, to get justice, I think.
Thank you, Council Member. Council Member Sisk.
Yeah, I just wanted to, I was thinking about all of the things that we're talking about, and while we're focusing on places like rancherias and things that make the Indian people recognized today, was not the criteria of the killings that took place. And it wasn't the criteria of the taking of the lands for that. And in my mind, it's hard to think that unless we address the issue of the California Indian identity and the reality that was given under the California claims case, and that the judgment rolls that were taken identifying who was eligible for those benefits. And it, along with that, you know, our tribe is on the McLeod River. We have no land on the McLeod River because of Shasta. And what happened with the state water projects is continuing to happen now. But the main thing that we are fighting for are the Chinook. It's like, we're not even talking about the resources that were withheld from or taken away from us so that we could actually function in our territories the way that we should be able to. And so the fish and the water, the trees, the things that have made tribal life was taken away and replaced with, in our case, merely poverty. Even though there was court action, there were acts of Congress to address the taking of that river and providing water to the entire state that never was fulfilled. And so, you know, the unrecognized tribes have not benefited since the 80s in the same manner. It's like they've created in California after this California report came out, it was the definition to separate individual Indian people, even though the claims case addressed you how much Indian blood you were and what tribe you were from. But they couldn't put it together to say, oh yeah, look at all these Wintus. They must be a tribe. But no, we're going to have them reapply for the group, for the collective, even though individually they have already certified that these people are members of this tribe that was here before 1850. And so the situation comes is like, something has to happen with that. Something has to address the unrecognized tribal people here in this state and the lands that they lost and the lives that they lost and the whole situation that we're in right now. You know, the tribes are getting COVID funding. We're not. We're not able to address all of those things that other tribes get. You know, we're not even able to apply for language grants or road grants or housing grants that come through because, you know, as long as the BIA has the ability to ignore the California claims case and the judgment roll that the court said we were eligible for all services of the BIA. It didn't say we have to be a recognized tribe to be eligible for the services won. And that should be upheld. It was a 50-year lawsuit. People died that whole time that started the lawsuit before it ever ended. And then we have it for like 8 years and then it's gone. Why is it gone? Can we find that out? Why were they able to put together a policy that overrides a court action? But also back to the fish. We need to protect our fish.
Thank you, council member. I'm seeing a lot of nodding heads about the fish. So are there any other council member comments on scope? Council member Burris. And then I think council member Kessler Mata.
One thought I keep having is that at the end of the day, this is a community-driven process. So are we, if we're saying we're only looking at the scope, are we telling the community this is the only thing we want testimony on? Or are we telling the community you can give us testimony on, you know, whatever you want? And if that's the case, isn't the testimony we receive really going to kind of define the scope of what we're looking at?
I think that's a valid point. And I think you can do both. And so kind of what I'm going to propose later, so I'll just say it now, is that you as regions meet and do listening sessions on a monthly basis, and those are open-ended. And so if you hear anything that could expand your scope because you're not limited in doing whatever you want, you can incorporate that as you have those listening sessions. And then separately, it might be worth, and I think this is part of the conversation, it might be worth kind of reining in some thinking so that you can prompt those discussions as well, understanding that you may get more than what you're asking for. So the like, let's say, you know, we're upset because our kids don't know our languages. How do you reverse engineer that and talk about what the problem is there? And how do you have that conversation? So just some thoughts that you could probably do both. Council member Kessler Mata.
Yeah, thanks. So I was thinking along those lines. I agree both with what Chairman Macaro said earlier, as well as what Burris is kind of suggesting here as well, that we not limit the scope, right? So even though I want structure, I want function, I also understand like we absolutely need to be fluid about this. Because what's going to happen, I think, is if somebody starts talking about, say, an ICWA-related incident, right? It looks federal at first, but it's at the county level that those things are actually happening, right? So we have to think about where the implications for the state are. So we shouldn't probably preclude anybody's comments because they're going to likely have some source or origin or relationship to state actions. But that I also think we should focus to some extent on identifying at some point, right? Again, at some point, what those state apparatuses are that are still working with tribes actively. And then those that aren't, why aren't they, right? Because they probably should be. With the executive order at the federal level, we see that continued commitment to consultation by all of the different departments and so forth. What can we do? I'm already at the let's solve this problem, but can we do the, can we make sure that not only do we have an active evaluation of how well state agencies are consulting with and engaging with tribes, but what are the kind of challenges that tribes themselves are facing in working with those state agencies and so forth? So that's community on the one hand can be just general, right? The native groups and individuals, tribes, whatever, NGOs, tribal NGOs that are working in particular regions, but then we also have the government-to-government relationship between the state and the tribes that we have to be, I think, strategic about making sure we're getting all of the tribes federally recognized and unrecognized involved in that conversation.
Thank you. And I think that is precisely why I'm here, and also why the state is part of this, is that if you guys have things that we should be looking internally at, you know, whether it's funding for language programs, whether it's consultation, whether it's, you know, land and all of that, we can do that work internally and bring that to this council as well. Council member Giovanetti.
Yeah, I want to say in regard to the last comment, the previous comment that close to my face, that one of the areas that the state might be weak in, as most states are, is in the data reporting, identifying Indians. And whether it's murdered or missing American Indian women. I know I had a first cousin in my tribe, in my family, that was killed by a serial killer who's focused on American Indian women. He was an Anglo. And he is an Anglo. And whether it be murdered or missing American Indian women, or whether it be COVID victims. And I was recently a COVID survivor. I spent 66 days in a hospital, just got out 2 weeks ago. And the report I got back from the doctor, they described me as a 70-year-old white male. And I told my doctor, I go, white male? I said, doesn't being a quarter blood still count? So he was a good sport. He said, well, that's too bad. Sorry, they identified you as a non-Indian. But that kind of stuff happens all day. And I think that somehow the state needs to be more responsive and just saying, well, they're mixed blood. They're everything. We can't count them as an Indian, or not even ask. Worse yet, not even ask. Thank you.
Thank you, Council Member. Council Member Bohorquez.
Thank you to all my fellow council members. These are all great topics and points, and I wholeheartedly agree. You know, when you can't stop and just have a cutoff time. And Christina, you mentioned it, you know, a little while ago, is, you know, the state can bring these things together, whether it's consultation, whether it's language, education. I look at the education that's being taught about California Natives, about us, that's inaccurate, that's not appropriate, that isn't, you know, doesn't need to be regionalized. There's just so much. And so to have that cutoff to say, this is the date that we're cutting off, this is the date that we're beginning. And right or wrong, I mean, it's up to all of us here to decipher that, whether we take history and move through it, how we go through. Councilmember Burris, I think, mentioned it excellently, is a lot of it is going to be coming from the Native community as we have public comment. What do they see? And I know there's so many people that want to speak and give their opinions, and they want to get involved, and they want to be able to do these things. And that's also going to drive the direction in which we go. And we need to wholeheartedly have our hearts open and our ears open to be able to listen to the community and move in that direction. So I just wanted to put my two cents in, and thank you, everyone.
Thank you, council member. Are there any other council member comments on this item? So from what I'm hearing, this is kind of an open discussion. And what I'm hearing is that it might be worth holding on trying to classify or reverse engineer until you get more input from the community. And then also, as that's happening, then we can kind of think about how to turn internally and address some of the things that the state should be bringing to the table. Okay, so we'll keep this kind of as an open item, especially in the event. Well, let me know if you want it on the next agenda, and we can talk about that at the end of the agenda. But it sounds like this is kind of going to just be an evolving process, and you've got some time to think about how to or how not to impose organization on what you get from the community. So we'll put a pin in that if that's okay with the council. Okay, then we'll open up for public comment. Again, you have 3 minutes if you'd like to give public comment.
We have a couple of hands raised. We'll start with Danny Cranmere. 1 second. Danny, you should be able to unmute yourself now.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, I'm Danny Cranmere. I'm a licensed clinician. I reside in the state of New Jersey. I am a Hashimam. I'm very involved with my Hashimam tribe. I have several family members who are also very active in tribal affairs. We are all about recognition. I have a question with regards to state-recognized, non-federally recognized tribes. And recently in my research, I had stumbled upon a graphic, an infographic, which illustrated nearly the entire South and Southwest as the areas that don't have federally recognized tribes. And it kind of, not to say that it went viral, but in the community, it did. I have an AKA or a artist name and brand of Sophia Phylos. So therefore, that is my social media name. I am also a business a consultation company, and I provide clinical services and specialize in trauma, crisis, and risk management. One of my largest concerns with the recognized and non-federally recognized, the state recognized, non-federally recognized tribes and the COVID deaths and complications from COVID impacting our indigenous community due to the language and the culture that resides with our beloved elders who are most at risk living in our intergenerational homes. And the way that this impacts an individual and the tribe and the families, and we are largely invisible. I jokingly refer to my people as ghost people, because as I am provided education from elders in my community about my own family and our participation in the tribe for ever, as I am Ush Ishwut Kuktum, or of the Wolf Clan, the Lobo family. And when I say that we are invisible, we have a collective memory that exceeds the colonization. We have family history that exceeds or precedes the colonized state of California. We do have the state recognition, which is wonderful. But with this crisis, we are losing people, and we are dying. And with missing and murdered Indigenous women, I wanted to speak to tribal members who are in the same legal status to file for an emergent relief from the government to grant federal status, because blood quantum cannot quantify the intergenerational damages from the neurocognitive effects of intergenerational trauma, in addition to the conditions that were created by the state and the states and the U.S. government. Our sovereignty is very, very important, of utmost significance. And the fact that we are not federally recognized hides the data. We are not other. I am not invisible. And now I know I'm preaching to the choir, but what we need is the state to look at the red tape in the infographic that I'm discussing and referencing, which, by the way, comes from a verifiable source, and look at the red tape, which is a glaring, glaring problem. It literally looks like it should be the textbook image for what red taping is. And the people in our community are not invisible. Our death, our human trafficking, the issues of substance abuse and trauma, both intergenerational and personal, we have to do something. That is all I have to say. Or I don't know what the question is. How do we get there? Are we willing to file for an emergent relief? It can easily be substantiated as necessary with the deaths, in my opinion, although I don't know who's tallying those numbers, because the more I get into research about the effects of trauma and the tribal stuff, I just read about the 18 treaties today, ironically, and they are at the crux of where the land issue. And we have the sacred land, you know, that we need to keep it sacred. People need to go there. They need to pray. They need to, you know, have the spaces respected. We're not invisible. There's no denying that we're here. And I refuse to let them check that white box. Whoever that other person was, I refuse. I will not check it. But I am, you know, also Caucasian, but I'm not totally Caucasian. So, but, you know, there's blood quantum does not quantify intergenerational trauma effects, and it is a completely inhumane, racist system of oppression that comes from the colonizer. Why should we submit to this, you know, to that? It's wrong. All it means, it's a facet of extinction and termination. The state needs to recognize that.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Cranmer. And I apologize for interrupting, but we do have several commenters. And so we do welcome your comments. We'll have some follow-up listening sessions. And if you'd like to submit written comments, we're happy to take those. So I apologize for cutting you short, but I do want to make sure that we can get to our other commenters. So thank you.
Okay, the next person ready to speak is Sister Who Walks With Bearers, followed by Shariah. Sister, you should be able to unmute yourself.
Thank you. Matrixus. My name is Marge Groh Eppard. I'm with the Nation of Miwok, and I see that I have 3 minutes to speak, so I will make this short. Thank you to the councilman who mentioned MMIW. I'm president of Missing Murdered Indigenous Women and People of California. And I would like to see more brought up about what California can do to help us stop this genocide that's spreading across Turtle Island. Thank you.
Next up to speak is Shariah. You should be able to mute yourself.
Hi, everyone. My name is Sharia Souza. I'm the executive director for the American Indian Cultural District in San Francisco. And I was just listening into some of the comments that you all had on scope. And I just really want to be mindful and bring it back that, you know, over 80%, according to California Consortium for Urban Indian Health, over 80% of our American Indian population is urban. And I think that I feel like we forget a lot of that sometimes at the state level when we're talking about government to government consultation and some of the impacts that the state policies have. And I think that one of the individuals brought it up, but really just think about the trickle-down effects of what happens when you're talking to, you know, Department of Public Health. Are we making sure that when we're, you know, submitting things at the state level that it's impacting the county level? Right now, you know, Native American Health Center is running at a deficit in order to run their own COVID-19 vaccine program, where mayor in San Francisco is handing out 28 million to our Latinx relatives and 120 million to our Black relatives. Our American Indian relatives are getting less than $2 million. So when we think about urban populations, you know, just on my board alone, we have people from Pay River, we have got folks from WAPO, Round Valley. I mean, those are your people too. you know, and they don't live on your reservations or in your areas, or non-federally recognized tribes don't even have a place. You know, Aromatush aren't even non-federally recognized, qualified for the, you know, Native American Heritage List. So I just want you to be mindful in your scope. Just remember urban Indians, and remember when you're doing things at the state level, you know, that those impact our urban Indian relatives as well, because I used to work at the state level. I've sat in some of those, you know, tribal liaison meetings, and we totally forget what happens at the county and the city level to our urban Indian people. So I just wanted to urge you for things like Department of Public Health specifically right now, because our Native folks and the way that we're running vaccines for urban Indians shouldn't be run at a deficit. Friendship House Association, that's doing outreach and recovery stuff right now, shouldn't be fighting for funds. So just when you're making those decisions, be mindful. It's not just about government to government stuff on, you know, existing things that we have, really great things with, you know, tribal cultural resources and other things that are happening, but just the immediate needs that we're dealing with COVID-19 right now. So thank you.
The next speaker to speak will be Carrie, and then followed by Taria. One second. Carrie, you should be able to unmute yourself.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, great. My name is Carrie Herthel, and I live in my ancestral homeland of Monterey County. I'm Eslin Rumson Shalon, and I'm the cultural officer for the Eslin Tribe of Monterey County. And I wanted to speak today to the Truth and Healing Council to bring up around the scope the truth and the needed healing of human trafficking that exists as a result of missionization starting in the 1700s in California. And that problem is still a genocide that is happening today. I want to lend information about the Sovereign Body Institute and the gathering of information, as well as the different agencies that are now calling us to the table to sit, to talk about California's history. I sit on several of those coalitions, such as San Francisco Coalition to End Human Trafficking, Monterey County to End Human Trafficking, Sovereign Body Institute, the youth law that is CSEC, that is now calling for an Indigenous advisory person. And so I'm really seeing that this needs to be important, the effects of our history and how it is very much alive and very much intersects with murdered and missing in California, and it impacts natural disasters that are happening in California, such as our fires. We're finding that, you know, the rate of trafficking, labor and sex trafficking is on the rise and increase. I also want to state publicly that I am a survivor of sex trafficking, and I am a descendant of human trafficking in California. Thank you so much for your time.
All right, Taria, you should be able to unmute yourself.
Thank you very much. My name is Taria Smith, and I'm a tribal member from Torres Martinez, Desert Cahuilla, down in Southern California in the eastern end of the Coachella Valley. Thank you all for the very, very important work that you're doing. I appreciate all of you and everything that's happening here with the Truth and Healing Council. I wanted to take the time to make a recommendation if I possibly could, because when I think of things that were lost in the genocide that occurred with our people here in California, I think primarily of language loss. And I wanted to make the recommendation that at some point there's advocacy for the state to provide funding for our tribal language programs. I know that my youngest is in going to school and to in university in Hawaii right now, and the state of Hawaii gives money for immersion schools for indigenous language preservation in the state of Hawaii. And I think that it would be valuable, extremely valuable, and a very good, how do I say it? A very good gesture of sincerity to be able to give back something that was so dear to us that was lost, and which is our tribal languages. And that's my suggestion. Thank you so much all for your time. And I look forward to seeing the progress of how this council moves forward.
Next up is going to be Kathy, followed by Eduardo. Kathy, you should be able to unmute yourself. Kathy Corey, you should be able to unmute yourself.
Haley, can you hear me?
Can hear you now, yes.
All right. I, first of all, would like to acknowledge the land on which I stand, which is the Yokut land in the Central Valley. I am exceedingly happy that the membership of this council includes non-recognized tribes, but I really feel that the membership should also include those who have been disenrolled from their tribes in California. There are over 11,000 people within the entire Turtle Nation that have been disenrolled, and the great majority of them have been in California. I think that the lateral violence that has occurred as a result of colonization within the tribes has been very detrimental to Native people in this state, with so many disenrolled from their tribes. And without addressing that, I think that a truth and healing council is not addressing a huge part of the problem. So I really appreciate that this council has come together and is here to address issues of California Native people. And I believe that tribal disenrollment is a huge portion of the problem that we have here today and would be greatly addressed within this council. I think that some of the members of council brought this up during your first meeting, and I would like to say I reinforce it entirely to speak to these issues. Virtually all of the people disenrolled in California are a part of California judgment rolls. And it's sad that one can be Native one day and not Native the next day, according to, you know, the official calling of these people. It's a travesty to our young ones coming up. It is a portion of what I hear addressed by the undercount of Indian people in California. And it is definitely oppression of our own people by our own people, and sadly a result of the colonization that has been imposed here. So I really appreciate all of your hard work, and I'm looking forward to attending many, many of these meetings online. And I'm exceedingly happy that you have decided to have a public comment period. And I think it would be a great idea to include a representative of the disenrolled Indians in California on this council. So thank you very much, and blessings to you all.
Hey, Eduardo, you should be able to unmute yourself.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, guys. Good evening here in Brooklyn, New York. My name is Eduardo Gonzalez. I am a Latino man, Peruvian in origin. I worked in the Peruvian Truth and Reconciliation Commission that was created after the internal armed conflict that rattled my country between the 80s and the year 2000. And after that experience, I have been working with Truth and Reconciliation Commissions in different parts of the world in an organization called the International Center for Transitional Justice. I stayed there a few years. And within that experience, I was able to accompany the work of the Canadian Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the Wabanaki People's Truth Commission in the state of Maine. So it has been very, very interesting to follow your conversation. And I think it's fabulous. I do commend you for having opened your proceedings and to have a public comment. What I wanted to comment and perhaps propose something to you is that the Truth and Healing Council is operating at a time in which many truth commissions are being created in the U.S. I have counted with some colleagues in the organization where I am now, in George Mason University, about 20 truth and reconciliation commissions happening in different parts of the U.S. And I wonder whether it would be useful to establish some kind of cooperation or exchange of knowledge with those institutions. The second thing is that recently I wrote a paper on the history of indigenous truth commissions, tracing the experience of truth commissions in Latin America, primarily the Commission of Peru, the Commission of Guatemala, Brazil, Paraguay, that is commissions that have worked with indigenous peoples, but then commissions that emerged from indigenous peoples, like the Canadian, the Maine Commission, and new experiences that are happening now in Australia and in Finland. So I would be very honored if you were interested in receiving my paper. I prepared it at the request of Ms. Anne Nworgam, who is the president of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. So if this document is of interest to you, I will be very happy to submit it for your consideration and to see whether this is useful for you at all. And of course, I will be very happy to try to set up any kind of exchange that you may consider useful with members of former Indigenous Truth Commissions. Thank you so much.
Next commenter is Lupita, and then followed by Eileen. Lupita, you should be able to unmute yourself.
Hi, my name is Lupita Torres, and thank you guys for having this meeting. This is really amazing. I'm elated right now. I would like to speak on the need for the governor's office to work with counties to advocate for the hiring of Native American culture coordinators to help support and focus on issues affecting local tribes in each county, regardless of federal status. I would also like to suggest that we all advocate and help establish Title VI grants within our local school districts due to the disproportional rates of suspension and chronic absenteeism affecting our Native children, which, as you all know, results from the systemic and historic racism and discrimination towards our communities at the hands of the authorities. I would also like to suggest that we put on our radar the need to provide culturally relevant rehabilitative programs for our youth in the juvenile justice system and the need to establish juvenile justice councils in each county within the criminal justice system to help stop the school to prison pipelines. Each county has a community corrections partnership, giving the public a direct seat at the table with the DA's office and the other actors in the criminal justice system. Through the community corrections partnerships, we're able to provide information and potentially establish relationships through the local counties to work with the discrimination and providing programs which reduce recidivism into the incarceration within the jail systems. This is a very important issue. I haven't heard about that being brought up yet. And so I just wanted to put that on the radar. And I wanted to thank all of you for bringing up all these important issues for our children, for our communities. And regardless of status or federal enrollment, we should all be incorporating all the issues
that are affecting our children. And thank you for this work, everybody. Hope.
Hello?
Yeah, Eileen, you should be able.
Okay, hi. Eileen,
you might need to mute something. You're feeding back on another device.
Okay, how's this?
That's much better. Thank you.
Okay. Hi, my name is Eileen. I come from the Yokeo and Robinson Rancheria. I'd like to thank you guys for having this Truth in Council. I've been following you for since you decided to have it. I work for the state of California. I recently started a Native American Human Rights Committee for SEIU, the largest union here. It's all across the state. I'd like to work with you in as being a part of this because we are across the state. You are the state. I also work with MMIWNP. I also know that James Ramos just got bills passed for MMIWP. For our voting, for our repatriation. I also know that in Lake County, they started their curriculum for the true history of the Pomo people, what happened, and it's going from kindergarten to 12th grade, and I think that should be everywhere. That could be used as a tool to go across the state. I'm looking to work with you guys so much, and I thank you for all you're doing for all of us. Thank you.
And AJ, you should be able to unmute yourself and speak.
Yes, I have some concerns regarding the disenrollment moratoriums for our Native youth. I've been an equal worker as well as a social worker for Child Welfare Services. And what I'm finding is that they might have a long lineal heritage, but nothing matters if their parent isn't enrolled and we're overlooking their cultural history, especially for those that continue to live on the reservation and rancherias. My husband was an enrolled tribal member since long before, and his parents and grandparents were under the California Rancheria Act. And then prior, we have documentation all the way back prior to 1951 when his great-grandfather was born. His language, 1851, excuse me. Thank you, honey. 1851, and his language was documented. The Caddo language was documented by a Plenty Era Goodyard, and they're using it to reinstate. But there is a lot that goes along with not only the disenrollment, but also the cultural genocide and the traditions and spiritual healings that go with this. And to have a Truth and Healing Council that have people as members who also participate in the disenrollment and moratoriums, I don't know how you can begin the healing. My husband was a lineal descendant from the Yurok and Hoopa people, as well as, and when the Hoopa Yurok Settlement Act came out, the Yurok people, Sue Mason and a couple others came down to our area and found my husband's father. And that's when he found out that he was a lineal descendant from the Yurok people. And even with all of that, and through the hearing, he was disenrolled from his birth tribe, where he was an enrolled member on the actual official tribal rolls. He had been a tribal chairman, and as well as his brother and his grandfathers before him. And to be out for 25 years, and we still work for this tribe. We still help with this tribe. We still live on the reservation. We do everything we can to help progress our Native youth. But I'm finding that not only with our the disenrollment here, but there are youth that come through under ICWA through the tribal courts and through the state courts, rather, not tribal court, that they are not considered because my husband's children were disenrolled as well. And it's not a good, healthy place to be, even though they have no right to tell tribes who their membership should be and not be. This is an additional cultural genocide that is being created by our own people. And this really, how to have a Truth and Healing Council is beyond me. when I see the destruction going on every day with the children that we're losing and our cultures and our traditions. Thank you.
Okay, that's the last hand raised. Oh, yeah, that's the last hand raised.
Okay, thank you, James. So we are getting close to time, but I do want to try to get through as much as we can before we end for the day. And then what we could do is either defer to another business meeting, or you can defer to the next regularly scheduled meeting, which will be in March. So just laying that out there. The next item is subcommittees. For a very brief background, there was some discussion of creating subcommittees, and there's already some ideas about what might be good. There was some discussion about creating a youth council, which could be created as a subcommittee. And the purpose would be to have a space for youth to have a delegate or have some work that is associated with this space. The other two, which we can take them all kind of in one conversation, are partnerships for academic partnerships. And so that subcommittee would be working on when we get offers from, you know, scholars and academia, would be working to engage those folks and figure out what they're offering or not offering and bringing that back to the council for recommendation. And then the other one would be funding. And that's the space where for foundations and the like. We've had some conversations about funding even restorative justice and reparative work. That committee would be the lead on that, and we would help staff all of those. The purpose of subcommittees, just as a very, very 1 minute brief explanation, is that because this is, you know, an open body, a state body, there are certain requirements that you have to have in order to do the work in a public and transparent fashion. Subcommittees gives you the flexibility to do the work outside of something, a meeting like this, which can help you have more flexibility. And then any official action has to come back to this committee. Subcommittees are limited to 2 people. So just 2 people, 2 members of the body. You can have other people helping you, but I'll stop talking now. Is there any discussion on this item? And really, the discussion is whether to stand up these proposed committees or if there's any others, and you could act to do that or not. Councilmember McCarroll?
I think Youth Council and academic partnerships are self-explanatory. Can you just elaborate a bit on the partnership, on the funding partnership concept?
The funding partnership, sure. And the funding partnership concept is having a lead to engage with different foundations and also do the work of if we wanted to go get grant funding for the council, or if we wanted, if someone was approaching the council saying, you know, I want to fund, you know, media and outreach for this council, it would be the point person for that. Is that clear as mud? Should I?
No, that was good. Helpful. Thank you.
Or if there were thoughts about creating a foundation separate from this mechanism, that could also be under that purview. Councilmember Kessler-Mata.
Hi, yeah. So I guess the thing that I'm unsure about is when it comes to our general work, right? So within our regions, are we bound to our geographic regions for the outreach and such? I know it's kind of merging the 8 and 6 on the agenda, but the reason I ask is because Youth Council seems very, you know, trans-regional, right? All of these kind of are. I'm thinking through, though, the challenges. Like, so I was considering, I think Chairwoman Sisk had, Chief Sisk had mentioned before, a possible committee on unrecognized tribes. What I'm hearing from various folks based in public comment and so forth, about the need for disenrollment. I'm just thinking considerations outside of federally recognized tribes. Maybe there needs to be a committee that is a point place for, you know, making sure we're always have an eye on unrecognized issues or enrollment issues that may come up. So there's a voice or a vehicle for that. And maybe that would be a subcommittee, but I'm not sure if that's the correct structural place for it.
And so I have no specific thoughts on that, but just for the council to think about is, as you move forward, and if you do think about refining this by issue area or by problem, like disenrollment, like identity, like visibility, you could stand up those committees to start refining that further and engaging on that work. So here, where there is a clearly identified issue, it could be worth creating that on the front end. Council Member Giovanetti.
I was going to say that the visibility would be, I think that we could do some interesting mapping of the problems associated with marginality. Just the myriad of ways that tribes that are Native American, California Natives are marginalized by institutions, by politicians, by political thought, you know, across the spectrum. Some thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you. And then also, I'm sorry I didn't address the previous question, I think, from Councilmember Kessler-Mata of, you are not constrained to doing work on a regional basis. You're here because you have certain insights based on your origin. So both your tribal origin, where you grew up, the fact that several of you are urban Indians, several of you are not, but are living in the ancestral territories of other tribes. So all of your perspectives are helpful in statewide work. Some of the work you are going to be doing is regional specific. And so under Bagley-Keene, we are allowed to discuss other agenda items. So part of the, I'll just bring up for the item 8, I'm suggesting, and you don't have to do this, but I will do it just as staff if you aren't interested, but I am suggesting hosting monthly regional listening sessions with rotating council members being present so that each of you will have, if you've got 4 folks from your region, you'll each take on 3 of those a year. And you'll, Loretta or I will be at either all of them. But basically we'll take it by Northern, Central, Southern, and Eastern, and that'll be kind of an open conversation with the tribes within your region. And we'll specifically target those tribes and give those you the contact information of those tribes as well. In addition to making sure that it's publicly available for those folks who are not members of tribes, to get those regional concerns, which again would be dictated by the community. So if you are, you know, a member of HOOPA but living in LA, you may want to attend, you know, the central region just for those specific concerns, but it would be up to the community. So that will be one layer of the work that you're doing, but you can also do cross-state type of work as well. Councilmember Sisk.
You need to unmute yourself.
Sorry about that. I was thinking about the committees that are being established, and I agree that those are important subjects to cover, but I don't want to get away from the ideas that people have brought up about the unrecognized and disenrolled members of the California communities and tribes that are in dire straits for assistance and change. And so one idea I had was, I don't know what it takes to justify California recognizing all of the claims case people for services and identification for services, regardless of whether or not their tribe is listed on the federal recognition list. But I'm wondering if we could start a committee that would record or take tally of how many California Indians have tribal roll numbers at this time who are federally unrecognized and who are disenrolled members who, because of that judgment rule, seems like they are they're eligible for all of the services that this government's supposed to be giving, and also in getting some kind of trickle-down funding for the different things that are happening, which goes down to even to preschool, and having opportunities for schooling, for health, for you know, all of these, even in the ICWA, you know, because we're not able to utilize what they call is reserved for only federally recognized Indians. Is there a committee or a place that we can begin looking at? What is that? You know, what does that look like? What would it take to fix that? That's what I was thinking.
Thank you, Councilmember Sisk. And that sounds similar to, I think, what Councilmember Kusla Mata had suggested of examining recognition or even the needs and status of Native peoples who are not federally recognized, whether it's, you know, through lack of membership or lack of recognition of their tribes. So just putting that as just a cap on that. Council Member Macaro.
Yeah, I wanted to speak then to the formation of subcommittees. I think that if we're going to create subcommittees that mirror subject matter or council scope, we should probably determine the council scope first, because then, you know, we'll be defining committees by topic or issue area without having determined the scope of the council, and it could just go off in any direction that the wind blows. So, you know, hearing the public discussion that we had, it's fascinating, and it's also a monumental task if we took on every one of those issues that was mentioned. We're gonna have to narrow our field and of work, just as a practical consideration. I mean, as it is right now, the concept of this council seems to be set to go on a few years. I don't know what the expectation is, 3 to 5 years, I think. So that we come up with a deliverable, because I'm already at the deliverable, by the way. You know, there are things that I have in mind that I want to get to that I think are likely owed to every California Indian, whether they're federally recognized or not, by virtue of the wrongs that California has committed to them. But we need to get to the sorting in terms of what is going to be council scope. And then I think from that, it might make sense then to readdress which subcommittees are necessary to address some of those. It's possible every topic or issue area we pick may require a subcommittee. I don't know. Just listening to the discussion today. So anyway, that's it for now. Thank you.
Thank you, Council Member. And so what it sounds like is... it may be worth this council spending more time in a listening and receiving space before picking those subcommittees. And then having that input, you can then take from the input what would make sense as subcommittees and already have that in front of you. So it sounds like, you know, unless it's something that is a bigger overarching kind of concept that has nothing to do with issue area, that it might be worth holding on that and doing a bit more listening, at least for the next several months to a year, as you receive more from the community. And then I did want to note, Councilmember Macaro, that I think as I'm hearing what this council is saying and what I'm hearing from public comments is that it may be worth doing both at the same time, or working from what are the solutions or what are the problems we see right now, and then working backward to fill that kind of context. But I'll stop talking there just to think about. Councilmember Myers.
Thanks, Christina. And just for the record, if Mark, you're putting a list of things you'd want, I got a couple I'd like to throw in, that real easy ones. I think we all do. Seriously, though, I do think there are some issues that, it, regardless of what our scope is or what we determine, are across the board issues I think we should be working on. Getting land back to us, I don't think we need a commission to determine that's what we need to happen. I think there's probably two or three that absolutely we run in parallel all the time. Increasing funding to tribes across the board, federal, state, or unrecognized, absolutely. Inclusion in data. I guess the question, I had two questions. One, I think, is being brought up is, do we want subcommittees now, or do we want them later? And should we wait for the scope? I don't know if we should wait for the scope of the meeting. That could, we could be out a long time. I do think we should move forward with, what did they call it, the last thing I did, a season of listening, which I thought sounded pretty cool. And I've used, so I do think we should go through a season of listening, and then we take some action. But I don't think I want to wait for all of that to be done before this committee at least starts to tackle at least one issue by the next meeting. And so if it is fair, I do think a committee on land back should be something that we could just unilaterally agree that, yeah, we should start having a committee going fired up right away to start funneling projects back to the larger commission here for stuff that we can work on, low hanging fruit. What'd you call it, Mark? Small ball, where you just, you know, bring some issues, get us a couple things that we can bring back that the commission could vote on and support immediately, whether it's to remove statues and say we would support, or if it's an action to bring a part of state parks back. I would like for this commission to actually, as soon as we can, start taking some action so that we're not, maybe we don't fall into the loop of being a metaphorical group only, that we only kind of think about things. But if we take some action too, if we put some physical things out there to actually get going, I would think that would help with the momentum of this group wholly. That'd be my suggestion as well. Thinking about committees is, let's put one together that we can actually start taking action on right now while we're also doing everything else.
Thank you, council member. Any thoughts on anything that was just, what I'm hearing is that there's actually a list that everybody has in their head of the things that are problems now, and everything that all of this council is saying and that I'm hearing in the public comments actually has a historical root that may have something to do with the state. And I think that this council's charge is connecting those things. And so while that does take some time for policymaking purposes, that is a very solid ground to move forward on. So that's just a thought there. So it may be worth hearing more, or actually actively soliciting, what are the modern day problems that we're seeing for California Native people. And I think that there's a very active youth element in that, because some of them are the most vocal of our community and are feeling it the most. So I guess the question again from Councilmember Myers, are there a couple of subcommittees that could be stood up right now? I'm already getting incoming from different UCs about how they could feed into this work or partner with this work. If you want to have academic relationships, then I would suggest creating a subcommittee that can more closely work on that and make those decisions, or at least bring that back to the council. If not, that doesn't need to happen too. So Councilmember Phelps?
I was just going to mention the academic subcommittee. I would be willing to serve on that. But I think that, you know, at the very least, we could start gathering information from these institutions, because that's probably the best thing they can do for us, and then hold that and present it to the committee, and then, you know, just bank it, which isn't going to, we're not precluded from doing that while we're forming other committees and actually kind of setting our agenda for the future. We can actually receive this information and bank it. So I think we should be able to proceed with that right away.
Council Member Kusla Kessler-Mata.
Sure. So yes, I agree with, I almost said Professor Phelps, but Council Member Phelps. And I also too would be willing to serve. I'm a member of the California Indian Scholars and Studies Association, which centers California Indians, readings of history and so forth. So to me, that's a really important one. But I think also the general function, we can conceive of the general function of these subcommittees as a place for folks to know that these are issues that matter. So again, when I think about establishing an unrecognized folks at the margin kind of committee, as Mr. Giovanetti was suggesting, it could be really having a place for people to, I mean, I know nobody receives our email addresses or whatever, but it could say like this is an important issue to us. And please, we're the people that are going to be paying attention to those specific issues. So funnel your comments here or whatever it may be, because I think it just seems really amorphous to folks. That's what at least some of the feedback I'm getting from folks contacting me, is that it just doesn't, they don't know how to direct their comments or who to reach out to. And if we've signaled that we've got some kind of subcommittee on these different issues, those of us, we can self-select into those subcommittees and then be paying attention, even if we're not taking action. It's just a place event, you know, it's like steam, right? It's like you're just letting off some kind of vehicle for collecting information and bringing it back to the council. So I would be comfortable, if anyone else is interested in having an unrecognized subcommittee, I don't know what else to call it at this point, and then we could just adopt the other three as well today. I'm not doing a formal motion, but if we want to add an unrecognized subcommittee and then move forward with these other three that are all on the agenda, on the list, I would be comfortable with starting there and moving forward.
Thank you. So I'm gonna, because we are getting to be short on time, I'm gonna go by item, and if you'd like to act on it, then someone can call for a motion or they can move. If you'd like to table it, you can also say that we'll discuss it later. So for a youth council, is that something that you would like to create at this point in time?
Yes, I think we should start moving on that.
Is that a motion?
So moved.
And then I heard a second from Councilmember Myers. Is there any panel discussion on that, or would you like to amend it to have actual membership, or would you like to, for that subcommittee, which would be two of these council members?
Oh, hadn't thought that far ahead. It just seems like we need to, that is one that I think we should have with us.
You can create them at this point, and then we can defer membership till later if people need more time. Okay, people are nodding. So council discussion on the motion on the floor, which is to create a youth council subcommittee. Hearing none, is there any public comment on that specific motion? And again, for those giving public comment, it is just on this motion. So if you are not commenting on the Youth Council Subcommittee, then please lower your hand.
There's currently two hands raised.
Sorry, what was that, James?
There's two hands raised currently.
Okay, can you please allow them to comment?
Lupita, you should be able to unmute yourself.
Hello?
Diane?
Yes.
I apologize.
Oh, no, no, it's only for you. Only for you right now.
Okay. I apologize. I had an elder on the line that was unable to make a public comment previously.
Okay, so this is just for the open motion. So you'll have an opportunity to give a public comment a little bit later.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Next hand raised, AJ. You should be able to unmute yourself. AJ?
Yes, thank you very much. I would like to see a youth council, but have representatives from different regions and areas serving on that as well so that their voices are heard. They also are affected by disenrollment and the cultural genocide that's going on. Life-term events, including health with the increase in substances, and then not being recognized in the courts and being taken away and put into non-Native homes. Thank you.
Next hand raised is Danny Kramer. Danny lowered their hand, so the next hand raised is Urban Brooklyn. Urban, you should be able to unmute yourself. They lowered their hand, so.
And again, as a reminder, this is just as to the substance of the motion, which is to create a youth council.
Danny Kramer has their hand raised again, so.
Yes, please go ahead and unmute.
I believe that children are greatly benefited by opportunities in leadership and to cultivate scholarly skills through real life experience. And so my public comment here from an unrecognized perspective, but with a deep understanding of psychology as a therapist and the human development of the child, I definitely endorse that as an idea. I think it's a fantastic idea, and it will strengthen the community and therefore increase protective factors in the community, which are the harm reduction approach towards trauma in the community. So I'm all for that. I think that's great. That's it.
What's the last public comment?
Thank you. So then we'll call for a roll call vote for those voting members. Chairman Khan?
Yes.
Councilmember Kessler-Mata?
Yes.
Councilmember Macaro?
Yes.
Councilmember Burris?
Yes.
Councilmember Sisk?
Yes.
Councilmember Bohorquez?
Yes.
Councilmember Harper?
Yes.
Councilmember Myers?
E.
Councilmember Elliot Santos?
Yes.
Councilmember Turner?
Yes.
And Councilmember Phelps?
Yes.
Motion carries and a youth council is established. For the council's clarity and for scheduling, we'll get through this item. I will give brief updates and then I'm going to request that we put the items on a follow-up meeting to account for your schedules. And then if we are able to for CNRA IT, I can stay on for an extended public comment period after that, but I want to make sure that we're not holding the council hostage here. On the second piece, academic partnerships, is there interest in creating a subcommittee?
I'd like to make a motion to create a subcommittee on academic partnerships.
I'd like to second that. This is Joe.
Donk. Is there any council discussion on that? Hearing none, is there any public comment on that? And again, this is on just the open item of creating a subcommittee on academic partnerships.
Chief Sisk actually just raised their hand.
Please go ahead, council member.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that we're also including unrecognized tribal members as well as professors at institutions up and down the state, you know, and in regards to a priority for California Indians to be in some of these positions that out-of-state Indians seem to be filling before our local graduates are being able to apply for these jobs for our areas. In the case of UC Davis hiring the ex-chairman of the Cherokee tribe to run a center that, you know, it's not right. It's not right what he's doing when they have other people that should be in there to discuss the situations with California. But I just wanted to make sure that we're, you know, protecting our professors and the young academic graduates into these positions as well as the students who are coming up through the ranks.
Thank you, council member. Is there any other public comment or council member? And again, I would encourage if you have no amendments or opposition to the creation of a subcommittee on academic partnerships that you refrain from your public comment until we open up for just general public comment, as this subcommittee hasn't been formed yet.
Councilmember Giovanetti actually has his hand raised.
Go ahead, Councilmember.
Yeah, thank you. I wanted to say that I think that's that is a problem that in California universities, not everyone, but it's consistent of people from not from our tribes. Well, persons with nominal qualifications as Indian coming to teach in our universities. but I want to say that I think it's a little bit of a mixed bag. It's not just one way. It's not black and white. It's not completely binary. That UC Davis recently hired a descendant of a Northern California tribe, a person who I believe his ancestors on the California land judgment role, but who is not enrolled herself. So I give them kudos for doing that. And I think that person's in a tenure track position. So I know these are very difficult, hard fought, you know, it's a crucible of some sort, but, you know, but we do need to pay attention to it because the voice of California Indian scholars should not be lost. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, council member. And for those commenting, again, if there's no amendments to the substance of the motion, please, we ask that you limit your comments as we do have some council members who will need to leave shortly.
We do have one public comment. Antoinette Cordero. Antoinette,
yes.
You should be able to mute yourself.
You can hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay. So I just want to ask the council to make sure that if there is this academic partnership subcommittee, that both the committee members, subcommittee members, and the public have a very clear understanding of what's going to happen with the information that is imparted and who's going to basically own that information. This is sort of an intellectual property kind of issue. And quite frequently we run into the issue that people, members of the public come forward and share their information and share their stories, not knowing that somebody on that committee may be planning to use that information in further academic research or from further academic publications. So I just want to encourage you and urge you to make sure that there is a clear understanding among both the committee members and the public as to what's going to happen with the information that is shared as part of that subcommittee. That's it.
Thank you. Are there any further public comments on this piece?
No other public hands raised.
Councilmember Turner.
Yes, I just wanted to share with the other council members that I have served on this UC Critical Mission Studies Advisory Group, and within the UCs, there has been a lot of, in academia, a lot of inner fighting and who is the expert. So I just, the formation of who you choose, I just want to give you that heads up to know that that has happened with the very small work group.
Thank you, council member. If there are no further comments, then we'll call for the vote and we'll do a roll call vote again. Okay, council member Khan?
Yes.
Council member Kessler Mata?
Yes.
Council member Macaro?
Yes.
Councilmember Burris?
Yes.
Councilmember Sisk?
Yes.
Councilmember Bohorquez?
Yes.
Councilmember Harper?
Yes.
Councilmember Myers?
Yes.
Councilmember Elliot Santos?
Yes.
Councilmember Turner?
Yes.
Councilmember Phelps?
Yes.
Motion carries and a academic partnership subcommittee is formed. Given that the public comments are seeming to be a bit extended on each of these items, I'm going to request that we table the rest of the action items until the next business meeting of this council. And then I'm seeing nodding, so I'm going to go ahead and keep talking. What I am going to do in the interim is go ahead and set up monthly regional listening sessions. And I will have my staff reach out to each of you to see what kind of rotation you'd like to do within your region. And we will let you know the dates and we'll have you kind of sort out who would like to be available. Or if you can't be available, we will host them and then also make sure that you have access to those listening sessions. And that will be again on a monthly basis to just get a temperature check and make sure we're getting input outside of this meeting as well. And then what I'd like to do is go to agenda number, item number 9 for the next meeting date. What I'd like to do at least for the first several months or maybe up to a year is have, in between when the regular scheduled meetings are supposed to be, which are March, June, September, and December. Have at least one business meeting in the interim. Right now, it seems like it might be useful to do it on a monthly basis. You're supposed to have your regular meeting in March anyway. So what you could do is have the business meeting be part of that, and then have an extended day of public comment the day before. In the absence of having the cultural wellness practitioner selected. Does that sound okay? Okay, so looking at dates. Are folks available? And you would not need to necessarily attend the day before. That would be a listening session. If you did attend, that's perfectly acceptable as well because it'll be agendized and everything. The 26th, it's a Friday, and we'd want to go from probably 10 a.m. to 3 if possible. I'm seeing nodding. We have raised hands. Councilmember Macaro?
Pretty high percentage chance there's a conflict for me that day, not being able to participate. Apologies.
we could also do a partial day like this. Is that, and that we could do that on the 19th, the 12th, or the 26th, if folks want to do a 12 to 3 session again.
For what it's worth, the 19th is good.
Councilmember Bohorquez?
I would have a conflict on the 19th, wouldn't be able to participate. But I think if we did partials, I think that might be more amenable to council members. I know that would work for me on the 26th, or even if we could push it back an hour on the 26th would work for me for a conflict that I have.
Okay. Well, maybe what I'll do is have my staff reach out and we can actually get a doodle together and then we'll find the right time. And if we have to do the full listening session a separate day and we do this meeting not on a Friday, we'll do that. But we'll have the next business meeting of this council next month. And then we'll go from there. Does that sound right? Okay. Anything else before we open up for public comment? And if council members need to leave, they are able to. Okay, thank you, council. Wonderful meeting, and we will see you all next month. I'll be in touch with those dates on the listening sessions as well. And then, James, are we able to stay on for public comment for the until 3:30?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So if we have public comment, please go ahead and raise your hand and you'll have 3 minutes. It can be on anything, but if it's not something that's addressed in the agenda, the council cannot respond to it.
And just a reminder, anybody that's dialed in, you press #2 to raise your hand. Otherwise, if you're on the Zoom, there is the raise your hand feature in Zoom to raise your hand.
And again, if you joined after I announced this, if you're joining through CalSPAN and you'd like to dial in for a comment, the dial-in is on the agenda. It's at the bottom of the first page. And then you can also email public comments to info.tribalaffairs@gov.ca.gov. Okay, James, do we have any?
We have one hand raised so far. Eileen, I'll allow them to speak here shortly. Eileen, you should be able to unmute yourself now.
Okay, thank you again. Going back to the I have a cousin who is going to be there. She was asked to teach our language and she accepted. If she doesn't, how we learn our language from our grandparents and everybody else within our communities, and then having to get a teaching credential for that, it will take longer than what is needed. So I was thinking if something can be looked at that, because we don't learn our language in school, but yet they want us to teach it in school. So, you know, there's issues about that that I think could be looked at. That's all I want to say. Thank you.
Next hand raised is AJ. AJ, you should be able to unmute yourself. AJ.
Yes, I just wanted to ask if there is, so for people who doesn't have the ability to email in information to that link, is there an actual mailing address to send in correspondence?
Sorry, I can respond to that. Yes, there is an address, and it is not on the agenda, I apologize. If you go to the Tribal Affairs website, which is tribalaffairs.ca.gov, you can mail correspondence to the governor's office, and we will be in receipt of that. I will say that right now, because of COVID-19, we are not, like, we're not able to get it in a timely manner, but it is, that address is at tribalaffairs.ca.gov/contact-us. And you can mail that. You can also call us at the number that's listed there as well. And that is 916-373-3711. And we will get that as well. And we can help you get your comments in.
And is there also another way to get the prior minutes from the last meeting that we missed?
Those are not final yet. So we will post those as soon as we have a draft of them, and they will be in draft form, and those will be posted to the website as well. Okay. And yeah.
Thank you so much. This was a
I'm sorry, AJ, my hand pressed the button too quickly.
Thank you. I just wanted to say I appreciate being able to attend and listening to the comments and what people say, and I appreciate the openness. So thank you.
Looks like we have Danny wanted to make another comment. Give me a second, please. Danny, you should be able to unmute yourself now.
Hello?
Danny, yes.
Yes, hi. I was just wanting to reinforce the point and with regards to data and the use and collection of data from unrecognized tribes, federally unrecognized tribes, and the state that are state recognized, even when they're not recognized, but the unrecognized voice, I want to say, as far as the data goes, because there's this humongous whitewashing that is really kind of offensive, right? It does not lend credence to the identity of the people who are firmly rooted in the area and in incredible ways, academic and culturally, food and the people and the worldview and the children and so forth. So I just want to say how important it is to recognize the unrecognized self, you know, whether it's self-identified as, I don't know if that's the wrong term, previously identified but the invisible voices. We need no more invisible voices, no more ghosting, no more ghost people, no more ignored data. Our community is so incredibly impacted by the trauma, substance abuse, the intergenerational trauma and its effects that we really need to increase the protective factors in the community. And so funding for tribal affairs and for cultural transmission and for tribes to have the members teaching the language and the all of the very important aspects that define us as a people to become clearly able to be seen and heard. Thank you. Thank you so much for what you're doing. I think it's fantastic. Sorry to use your time.
Leslie, you should be able to unmute yourself.
Hi, thank you very much. I just wondered again to hear the information. I think earlier it was said that you're looking for a southern coastal area representative. Is that right?
Yes. So right now we're until 11:59 p.m. tonight accepting nominations for the southern region, which is San Diego and Imperial counties, and okay. For a non-federally recognized tribe.
Okay, because I'm more involved with the Chumash, Gabrielino, Tongva areas, but that's not what you're looking for at this point. Is that right?
Yes, I believe that I believe so, but there may be some San Diego. So I would just double check. I would double check.
And where would I check that?
Oh, one second. I'm going to pull up my list that I have. So this may take a minute. Okay, this is going to take a bit longer. If we can get your contact information, if you could email info.tribalaffairs@gov.ca.gov, we'll be okay. In touch with the specific tribes that are in those regions. So I apologize for not being able to do that quite as quickly as I thought I could.
Okay. Thank you.
That's the last public hand raised currently.
Okay, great. Well, if there's no further public comment, then we'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting. And then for council members, we will be in touch with some dates for March. So thank you all for your time and have a great weekend.